Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The Durham Report. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast to Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews they deserve on iTunes. Our sponsor this episode, by the way, is Pete Alonzo. More on that, more than many of our listeners want to hear very soon. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Riverside, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How are you?
Oh, after last night, I couldn't be better. I thought the season was like hanging by a thread there. You know, you just get this feeling because it's happened many times with the Mets that the wheels were coming off and they just, I mean, it was a miraculous win.
So yeah, it was a great win. Great I caught night. Up on ESPN this morning. But I've sort of come to learn no one game is as important as you think it is. Remember, what was that game, the Mets, several years ago? And sorry, Megan and all other listeners who don't like the baseball chatter at the top, but the Mets were going to trade someone, and then they didn't. It fell through, and he was crying
in the outfield,
and they lost the game, and it seemed like the whole season was over. And then they came back and made the playoffs that year, right?
Yes, and got to the World Series
and
lost. But Flores, that's right. He was crying on the field because he heard he had been traded, and then it turned out he hadn't been traded. So there you go.
All right. So there's some people who should be crying over the Durham report. I don't know why that segue really works, but they're not. They're never going to cry or show any regret, most of them. But we finally got this thing in. What are your big takeaways?
Well, I guess I have a personal thing about it, which I'm always hesitant about because the older I get, the more annoyed I get by people who like – inject themselves into the story. But I did sort of stick my chin out writing a book about this 4 years ago. And so I'm relieved that it holds up because I had a lot of misgivings about it at the time. So for me personally, I feel gratified that things I thought were problematic and needed to be more deeply investigated did get more deeply investigated. I'm not sure that we have good answers on that stuff, but I at least feel like on my end of it, it held up. And I think that Durham deserves a lot of credit. You know, he is what he is, which is a very diligent, patriotic, hardworking meat and potatoes prosecutor who has always been able in a scrupulous and trustworthy way to get from A to B to C without noise, without leaks, without a political agenda. I mean, he's been used by administrations of both parties to do this sort of thing. He was brought in by the Obama administration to look at the CIA interrogation program after he had been used by the Bush administration to do a same kind of investigation. So I think it's a shame. I bet you he would say, much like, Bill Barr obviously noticed that in the 30 years from the first time that he was attorney general until the second time, the political climate really changed in Washington to the point where it was hard to do his job the second time around in a way that it wasn't the first time around because it's so hyper tribal in Washington now. And I think if Durham would talk to the media, which one of the things I admire him for is that he won't, but I think if he did, one of the things he would say is that he's taken on hard assignments. I mean, if you go back to the CIA interrogation program, is what, 2004 or something like that? So, I mean, in 20 years of taking on these kinds of assignments, even though I don't want to pretend that in 2004, 2005, that wasn't a very hot climate, I don't think it's anything like this. Just the fact that Durham personally never got attacked until this investigation tells you all you need to know, because Durham hasn't changed. It's the political culture that's changed. But, you know, you have to take with him, that is all the good. I don't want to say bad, but the downside, at least, of the ledger is he has never been somebody who could be regarded as rapid, even in circumstances where if you're going to have accountability that matters in time, he may not be the best guy for the job, because his agenda is not political. His agenda is, by his high standards, getting it as right as he can get it. And as a result, you know, I think there are some people who cut through stuff more quickly. And he not only is methodical by nature, he had a lot of bad luck in this investigation because of COVID and the fact that grand juries couldn't meet, witnesses couldn't meet, etc. So it's a mixed bag. It's a very good report. I'm struck by the fact that he's been viciously attacked, as one would expect, by the media and the left that were so invested in the Russiagate investigation and perpetuated the lie, which he is exposing. So it's probably natural to expect that he'd be attacked like he's been attacked. But I think, Rich, and you've looked at some of the report. I've looked at probably a lot more of it. Just mm-hmm.
Thanks for exposing
well,
me.
This is sort of my thing for a long time. So it's kind of what you would expect. But the thing I come away with is, if you read his report, you wouldn't know that there was such a vicious attack on him, because, you know, for example, the people who are attacking him are saying, you know, the Inspector General report shows that, you know, you're all wrong, and we didn't need you in the first place. And, you know, Mueller's investigation was much more important. And Mueller's investigation, which also, you know, cost the country six times as much as Durham spent in a longer period of time. If you read Durham's report, he's very complimentary of Horowitz. He's very respectful of the work that was done by the Mueller report. He wants you to understand that he's not here to undermine them, that he's building on top of the work that he did. And in particular, with respect to the Inspector General, you know, the point is that he, as a full-fledged prosecutor, whereas the Inspector General has a mission to investigate misconduct, waste, fraud, and abuse, and doesn't have all the tools of a full-fledged prosecutor like grand juries and compulsory process that can make people cooperate, including people outside the government. He's a full-fledged prosecutor. He had much more in the way of investigative tools to go about this. So he's building on top of the work of Horowitz. He wants you to understand he's not trying to undermine it, and he doesn't. And they have important ways where they part company, which I think we should talk about a little bit. But you would not, Rich, in reading his report, if all you did was read the report and then you listened to the media, you'd be like, what is this? What is the commentary about? Because this guy is not, you know, you would think listening to the commentary that there's this vicious divide, and there's not in the report. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit more, because this is one of the things that Andy McCabe, who is now a CNN analyst, his post-FBI career, and he was on commenting on the Durham report, and he said, Durham's just wrong. This was already looked at by the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz. He found this investigation was properly predicated, so I don't know what Durham's talking about.
And you said McCabe is working at CNN now.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was removed from the FBI after the Inspector General report that he now says found that everything was peachy. I just want to make sure we're on the same page about what happened.
Is this how you used to do it back during the day, Andy?
It's still in my bloodstream. I can't quite get
it.
The witness I wish I had was McCabe. That would be a hoot. But, you know, it's funny. The disconnect, though, again, you know, you have all these guys on, and it's not just McCabe. I see Stroke is out there, too, which is almost as unbelievable as McCabe being out there. And they're saying the inspector general looked at this and found that everything was fine. And then if you listen to Chris Wray, he said, we've made all these changes in the interim before Durham's report to address all this misconduct. And by the way, have you noticed that none of those people who were involved in this investigation are at the FBI anymore?
Yeah.
You know? So, I mean, for these guys, it's just, look, they're just spouting political talking points. They're not dealing with reality.
Yeah,
and for McCabe,
by the way, McCabe thing on CNN reminds me a little bit Adam Kinzinger when he was quitting Congress, retiring, and going to CNN. He tweeted, "I'm so glad to be joining the CNN team." I was like, "You were always on the CNN team."
Right,
it's like it's right. The same thing with McCabe.
Oh, right, exactly right. But you know the thing with so McCabe comes flying out of the box saying that you know Durham just doesn't understand how the FBI works. And I'm thinking, Durham was working with the FBI, I think probably for 10 years before McCabe, you know, probably while McCabe was in college, Durham was working with the FBI. So to hear this dingbat say that he doesn't understand how the FBI, I think the problem is he understands only too well how the FBI works. And that's what the problem is here. But, you know, look, I think to go back to like to put this in the context of what I just alluded to in connection with the Inspector General report and Durham, because I think the place where they go in a different direction that's of greatest consequence and the thing that McCabe is most talking about is the predication for the investigation. And this is why a lot of this debate, Rich, I think it sounds like it's two ships passing in the night. Because even though they're looking at the same event, that is how the FBI opened this investigation, Horowitz, the Inspector General, and Durham are looking at it through two very different lenses with two different analyses. Horowitz, as the Inspector General, is looking for misconduct. In other words, did what they did violate the rules of the FBI that are laid out in their guidelines manual that the Attorney General and the Justice Department sign off on. I think the main manual was promulgated by Judge Mukasey in 2008, and then it was refined somewhat by Holder in, I want to say, 2013. But that's their guidelines manual, right? So here's what Horowitz says, which the people who were involved in this investigation have distorted it into something he didn't say. What he said was, looking at the very low threshold that the FBI has in its manual for when it's okay to open an investigation, I can't say that they violated their procedures in opening it because their standards are so low. Now, just so people understand, there's a reason for that. The FBI and the attorneys general, when they do this guidelines manual, they don't want to give defense lawyers a tool that can be thrown at the FBI and the Justice Department in investigations. If you're going to get evidence suppressed in a federal case, they want it to be because your constitutional rights got violated, not because the FBI didn't dot every I under its guidelines. So most of what the expectation is in the government is that the guidelines are going to lay out low minimal standards that you expect them to exceed, and that is going to happen at the supervisory level where trained experienced supervisors are going to demand that the agents in their charge exceed the low levels of what the guidelines say. So what Horowitz said is, in looking at the opening of this investigation, there's no technical difference under the guidelines between the average investigation and opening an investigation of great importance. And their threshold is so low, I can't say that there wasn't enough predication to investigate. But he makes two very important qualifications. He says, number one, it's not my job to say whether I thought this was a good idea or not. Mm-hmm. I'm strictly looking at the guidelines. And secondly, he says, strictly speaking, the guidelines are so low, it's just not possible to say that there wasn't enough predication here. Durham, on the other hand, is making the judgment that Horowitz expressly says he's not making, which is, was this a responsible exercise of investigative authority or not? And I think Durham's pushback on Horowitz in this regard is that Horowitz looked essentially at one guideline and said that it was a low threshold and they exceeded it. Whereas Durham would say he looked at a variety of guidelines, including the idea that if you are investigating a special investigative matter, which they call a SIM, that's a case that could intrude the FBI into politics, that you have higher obligations, and that what you're supposed to do is use the least intrusive means of conducting an investigation, because we don't want law enforcement intruding into politics, and particularly presidential elections. So what Durham says in this regard is, let's look at what the FBI did with Hillary Clinton. And he points out that there were other investigations besides Russiagate that the FBI was working on, where they had information on the counterintelligence side that they got, that foreign governments, he doesn't identify which ones, were trying to influence Clinton and her campaign, beginning in 2014, before there even was a campaign. And what the FBI's position in connection with those was, well, this is even before she was running for president. They said she's going to be running for president. In one instance, they waited 11 months to take any action because they were intimidated by the idea of intruding the FBI in. And then after 11 months, what they decided was, you know what, we're going to give her a defensive briefing and tell her we have information that a foreign government is trying to influence her campaign. They did the same sort of thing with a second investigation. So Durham's point is, there's a disparate treatment between the two campaigns. Now, he takes that narrowly, saying, you know, they can't justify the fact that they, you know, treated Clinton one way, and on the other hand, with Trump, they had an investigation that was so thinly predicated, it was a joke. They opened it as a full investigation. Durham makes this point also. The FBI has stages of getting to a full investigation. You first do an assessment, which is kind of like kicking the tires. And if that shows anything that's disturbing, you can move on to a preliminary inquiry. And then on the basis of the preliminary inquiry, if it's really disturbing, then you go to a full field investigation, which means you can use all of the tools that are available to the FBI. But it's supposed to be stages, and you're not supposed to jump to a full field investigation without having gone through these other hoops, unless there's something that's obviously an emergency and very, very serious. Here with Trump, they jumped right to a full field investigation 3 days after they got very sketchy information, before they ever spoke to a single witness, and the information they got was not even, I mean, we'll go into this, but I don't think there was any difference from what George Papadopoulos, I always want to say Stephanopoulos, what George Papadopoulos said to the Australians. I have a column coming on Saturday that says what Papadopoulos said to the Australians was no different from what Comey said to the American people in his press conference when he laid out the information about the Hillary Clinton emails investigation. But what Durham is saying here is they, with Trump, they jumped right to the full investigation for basically no good reason, without having done all the preliminary steps and without having taken to heart the idea that this is an investigation that involves politics, that could intrude on the American electoral process, and therefore that we are obliged to use the least intrusive means as possible. But they never even gave serious thought to giving Trump or anyone in the Trump campaign a defensive briefing. And when they were asked about that, they said, well, if we gave him a defensive briefing, that might have caused whoever, whoever was the Russian mole inside the campaign, we might never have found out who it was. That might have blown us out of the water. And what Durham says is, well, then how come that wasn't a concern with Hillary Clinton? You know, why were you concerned about it with Trump, but not with Clinton? They don't have a good answer to that. So what Durham does, Rich, is he uses this as this disparate treatment. As a suggestion that they were operating for bad motives. But he won't go further than that. And my objection to this is it's perfectly obvious here that if you just like look at all of the investigation that he did, they decided that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. They were intimidated to investigate her. At one point when they were going to interview her in connection with the Clinton emails investigation, Lisa Page says to Peter Strzok, tread lightly in this interview. She's going to be the next president. Mm-hmm. And she's not. Do you think that she's going to remember that the Justice Department and not the FBI was the one that was driving the investigation? She's going to, retaliate against everybody who was involved in her. She had them totally intimidated, and they were convinced she was going to win, and they allowed themselves to be used as an annex of her campaign. All of Durham's evidence, to my mind, tends in that direction, but he won't connect those dots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in believing that Hillary is inevitable, they are bad pundits on top of everything.
Yep.
Everything else. So obviously there's been a huge focus on the dossier prior to this, and a lot of the threads have been pulled here, and we know a lot about how absurd this thing was from the beginning. But what did Durham underline, and is there anything new that emerges from his investigation into this?
I don't think there's a lot new, Rich, especially after the Danchenko trial. I mean, we learned during the Danchenko trial, for example, that Steele was offered $1 million by the FBI to provide corroboration for his allegations in the dossier, and he couldn't come up with it. We found out that they brought Danchenko, who was supposed to be the principal subsource. He's the main guy that Steele was getting information in. They bring him in. They don't question him until late January of 2017, by which point they have gone to the FISA court twice and sworn to the truth of his allegations. So, I mean, to me, that is so mind-boggling. I still can't wrap my brain around it. I think people need to understand. Steele, it's not just that they liked Steele because he had this association with British intelligence. Steele was a signed-up FBI confidential human source beginning in May of 2016, before the Russiagate stuff ever got rolling, because they were doing an investigation of Putin and Russian oligarchs that Steele had insight into, right? So he was already on the books as an FBI confidential human source when he started to work for Fusion GPS, when he started to work for the Clinton campaign, when he started to assemble the dossier. The reason I bring that out is, given that he was a confidential human source and they were paying him, they could have at any time said to him, we want to know who your sources are. Name them to us so we can go interview them and corroborate this information. They never did that. So when they got this dossier, which on its face is dodgy, I mean, it's we've all read it, right? It's a really sloppy piece of work. you would have a million questions. They didn't ask any questions. They said, he's our old pal from British intelligence. We don't have to question this. So even though he is not, he's telling them he's not the source. He's got this network of people that he's dealing with. And it turns out the network is Danchenko. Mm-hmm. And Danchenko's got a bunch of people he talks to. But so they know they're dealing with hearsay information. They don't try to corroborate it. Their regulations, because FISA court proceedings, unlike criminal proceedings, we've talked about this a number of times, the only due process anyone gets is what the FBI and the Justice Department tell the court. Because it's not like a defense lawyer is ever going to see this stuff. There's not going to be discovery. There's not going to be an indictment. You're not going to be able to read what was it that the FBI represented to the court. None of that stuff happens. So the only due process we get is if they're honest with the court. And for that reason, under Mueller, when he was director of the FBI, they put in these procedures, which was supposed to be our safeguard, that when they brought what by statute they call a verified application for surveillance, that it actually is verified, which is every factual assertion that they make in a FISA application, they are supposed to have what's called a Woods file, named after the agent who designed this process. And in the Woods file is supposed to be factual backup for every assertion that they make to the FISA court. So if the FISA court can say to them, you know, what's your backup for this? What's your backup for this? They have something to tell the FISA court. It turns out that they didn't get backup for Steele's assertions. They just took them at face value. They put them in the affidavit because they knew they needed that in order to get probable cause. The main assertion in the affidavit that they used four times was that Trump was in a conspiracy of cooperation with Putin, which was the context for the DNC emails and everything else that happened. The claim that Trump was in a conspiracy of cooperation with Putin, supposedly, it turns out, came from Sergey Milyan, according to Danchenko. Sergey Milyan was this Russian businessman who's got some relationship with Trump. It turned out that Steele got that information from Danchenko. He says, Danchenko says that he told Steele that, Steele assumed that Danchenko had gotten that claim directly from Milyan. What Danchenko said was, Steele was under the impression that I had spoken to Milyan and I didn't disabuse him of that. So Steele exaggerated what Danchenko told him in the affidavit. And then it turned out that Danchenko never actually talked to Milyan. When he was pressed finally on the story, he says that he talked to some guy who had a Russian accent who he assumed was Milyan, but never established was Milyan. And it's not even clear that the statement that was made to him, whatever it was, by whoever made it, bore any resemblance to what Steele wrote in his report. The FBI gets all this and they don't talk to anyone. They don't sit Steele down and say, wait a minute, we're going to go under oath to the FISA court and say that there's a conspiracy of cooperation between the Republican presidential nominee, later the president. The last three times they go back to the court, he's president, right? They're saying to the court under oath, there's a conspiracy of cooperation between Putin and Trump. They don't ask Steele, like, how do you know this? Who told you this? And then they don't go back and talk to Danchenko finally until late January of 2017, after they have already twice said this under oath in court, okay? They sit down with Danchenko finally and they ask him about it, and it turns out that the whole thing is nonsense. And they ask him about the whole dossier, and he said, no, I didn't say that, no, I don't. He's exaggerating, this is rumor, this is... So all of the allegations they've been giving to the court under oath, he looks at it and says, this is nonsense. It's exaggerated. It's fabricated. So turns out they have to go back to the FISA court the next month, right? Because the thing is about to run out. When they go back to the, first of all, what's supposed to happen is as soon as they find out that they've given misinformation to the FISA court, their obligation is not to wait till the next renewal. They're supposed to go right to the FISA court and say, it turns out we gave you bad information. Instead, they wait till the next application period, which is 3 months later. And then when they make the application, they not only don't correct the allegations that they've made, they tell the FISA court, we've now sat down with Steele's principal subsource and we found him to be very credible. And they don't tell the court, oh, by the way, what he's credible about is all the things we've been telling you for 6 months are nonsense. That they don't say. So we heard all this during the Danchenko trial, but to just see it again and see the way it's laid out, and the thing I can't wrap my brain around still is on that record. So just understand, by late January of 2017, the FBI knows that the information in the dossier is complete nonsense. To my mind, they should have known that before they even submitted it to the court. But let's say they, you know, for whatever reason, they bought it, but they find out in late January that it's wrong. That should have been the end of this. Instead, Jim Comey, as the FBI director, goes into the House of Representatives on March, I can't remember which date it was, in March of 2017, and he gives testimony, he makes a public statement confirming the existence of a counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign. The FBI never acknowledges the existence of an investigation, particularly a national security investigation, which is classified. He gratuitously says that publicly, and he then adds at the end, and by the way, after we get through all of this, there could be people indicted at the end on the basis of what we generate. So this is weeks after they've been told that everything they've been telling the FISA court is nonsense. He goes into Congress and makes a public statement that he had to know. He's a sophisticated guy. He had to know every press outlet in America was going to deduce from that there really was collusion between Trump and Putin, and that people in the Trump campaign, including Trump himself, might end up getting criminally charged at the end of this. I mean, it's outrageous.
Yeah, shoving the water. So there's much more we could say about this, but there are a couple of other stories we should get in before we have to go. And obviously, right, the controversy over the Durham report will continue and will pick up threads as warranted. So the other big story, we have the arrest of Daniel Penny, the Marine involved in the subway altercation, resulting in the death of Jordan Neely, a homeless, untreated, mentally ill man. And first of all, it's weird, right? He's arrested kind of after the fact. They took him in for questioning right after the incident. They did not choose to arrest him. He has not been indicted, but he's been charged by Bragg. Some people think this is a way for Bragg to show the left, you know, he was really into nailing Penny to the wall, and if the grand jury refuses to do it, to indict, well, you know, it's not on for lack of trying on Alvin Bragg's part. But where do you think this stands?
Well, I think that's right. I think this was a completely gratuitous exercise. Bragg did not have to indict. You know, as you say, they took Penny agreed to, you know, surrender to the police, not surrender, but to go into the police to answer questions. He also retained counsel so that every minute since this incident happened on May 1st, the police department and the district attorney's office has known where Penny is and the fact that he's retained counsel. His lawyers have been talking to the district attorney's office every day. So ordinarily in that situation, Rich, the thing a responsible prosecutor would do is, okay, now we have to decide whether we're going to charge this guy or not, and you would charge him by an indictment. If you're going to charge him with manslaughter, that's a felony in New York law. It's not murder; it's not that high, but you can be sent to prison for it for a few years. So that's a felony, has to be indicted by a grand jury. So you would ordinarily begin the grand jury process, and instead, what Bragg did was decide to charge him in a complaint, which is not an indictment. It's a sworn statement, usually by a police officer or an investigator for the DA's office. And far as I can see, the only reason to do this was to, in a very public way, put Penny through an arrest process. And it would have been difficult for Bragg to do this if he had submitted this case to the grand jury and they had decided not to indict, which could happen. You know, all this business about, like, when people say grand jury will indict a ham sandwich. The reason I think people say that, Rich, is no prosecutor should ever fail to get an indictment from a grand jury that he asks for.
Yeah.
Right. So what the trick on this is, you at the end of your presentation of evidence, you say, that's pretty much the end of what we want to present to you. Is there anything that you're disturbed by, or are there any other witnesses that you'd like to hear from? And at that point, if it becomes obvious that the grand jury hates the case, you don't submit the indictment mm-hmm. to them. Mm-hmm. So the reason prosecutors bat 1,000 is they have the opportunity to know if the grand jury hates the case, you don't ask them to vote on an indictment because you're not required to do that. But there are a lot of cases that you get a sense that the grand jury doesn't like. And under New York law, unlike federal law, where you're allowed to proceed basically by hearsay in the grand jury, and you don't have to bring the subject of the investigation in, there's no obligation to do that. In New York law, you can't freely just rely on hearsay. You have to bring the actual witnesses into the grand jury. And if the subject wants to testify, you have to let him testify. And if the subject has supporting witnesses that he'd like the grand jury to hear, they pretty much have to call those witnesses too. So in this grand jury proceeding, as I understand it, Fox News has had some reporting on this. Penny's lawyers have told Bragg he wants to testify in the grand jury, and they have other witnesses they want the grand jury to hear too. So Bragg was in a position of, if I present this case to a bunch of New York grand jurors who ride the subways and would be delighted to have somebody like Penny on the car that they're riding in, they may not indict this case. They may decide, you know, even if there's a technical violation here, which it could be, you know, under the circumstances, we don't think this case should be charged. And we don't think that 12 jurors at a regular full-blown trial unanimously would find him guilty. Then Bragg would never have had a chance to signal to his, you know, to the people who put him in office. And remember, Bragg is an elected official. He's not a appointed law enforcement official. He's an elected official. So he needed to show his constituents, his heart, by their standards, was in the right place. And I think that's the reason he did the complaint. He may not, if he goes to the grand jury, he may not get this case indicted.
So how do you think, Andy, I'm with the Penny supporters, and this is a really admirable thing to do. So many people don't do it in the subway. They're too scared. They're too cynical. They just don't want to get involved. He stepped up in what I think almost certainly sincerely believed was a threatening situation. And we've heard from other witnesses that they were scared and believed it was a threatening situation. And you had two other folks helping him, not trying to, you know, not saying, "What are you doing? You're running out of control," randomly attacking a guy. All that said, the thing that gives me most pause is you have this, 4 minute long video of the end of this altercation. And at the end, you know, the subway car stopped. There are no cops there, but it's cleared out. You know, random passengers who would have been at risk are gone. And the only people you have, basically, there's some other people milling within sight, but these two guys helping Penny restrain Jordan Neely, and you kind of wonder, well, why can't you just let him go? And there's actually one guy who comes in and says, "You're killing him. Let him go. You know, he defecated himself. That's a sign. The end. That is the end, or near the end. Let him go." Now Penny does let him go immediately after that, and they try to get Neely on his side. He asks, you know, can you hear me? So this obviously, you know, that speaks to a lack of maliciousness and a wanting to render aid after the altercation was over. But I think that's the hard part for Penny and his lawyer. And again, as we've said in many of these cases involving cops, it's easy to second guess, you know, if you're not the one directly involved. And I talked to a former cop friend of mine who said, the problem is you get him in a headlock, you let him go, and then you're in a wrestling match again. That's why you would hesitate to let him go. And he also believes that he's skeptical that the chokehold was the thing that killed Neely, because he says you get a real chokehold on someone, they're out in like, you know, 10 seconds, right. and Neely wasn't. But anyway, what do you make of that aspect of this?
Well, I think, You have to remember that what we're talking about here is manslaughter, right? Nobody is alleging, well, we haven't seen what Bragg's going to do yet, but no one's alleging murder other than the lunatics on the street, right? And they're saying, as I often say, there's like these legal concepts that get thrown around. So there's the rhetorical use of them, and then there's the technical legal use of them, right? So when these people are saying he murdered this guy, they're not talking about, you know, what murder is under New York law. So what we're talking about here is manslaughter. Manslaughter is negligent homicide, which means you cause somebody's death by accident. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't mean to do it, but a mistake happens. Mm-hmm. So let's be mindful that that's what's on the table here, right? And we're also talking about a situation where, and we saw this in connection with George Floyd, this is kind of a different iteration of that. And also, you're not dealing with like uniformed police officers, but it's a similar kind of fact pattern in that you have a situation where the altercation begins lawfully. All the things you laid out about what Neely was doing and the threat he posed were true. This couldn't possibly have been known to Penny and the other people on the train, but this guy had been arrested 42 times. Some of the arrests are violent. He had just been in Rikers Island for about 14 months for punching an old woman in the face where he broke her nose and her occipital bone. So this threat was very real. This wasn't just like a guy who was like, you know, you hear, read some of this stuff was, oh, you know, he used to dance like Michael Jackson. That's not who this guy was by the end. He may have been that at some point, but he wasn't.
Yeah. People say, Andy, well, Penny didn't have access to his arrest records and, you know, didn't know about this case. But if someone's acting, you know, if someone's done that, they act like they might do that again. And, you know, human beings are very attuned to these sort of cues.
Yeah, right. We don't have the rap sheet of a lot of people we encounter who mm-hmm. seem to be dangerous, but when something bad happens, we're not surprised to find that they have a rap sheet, right?
Yeah.
So but this is the situation we're dealing with. So the way New York law works, which is not all that different from how Minnesota law worked in the George Floyd case, you have an altercation that began lawfully because he's allowed to use physical force in self-defense for both himself and third parties. So you're allowed to do that. If you're allowed to use force and self-defense, it can be superior force. If you are lethally threatened, you could use lethal force. I don't think there was an intent here to use lethal force, but there may have been a use of lethal force. And then the other thing that's difficult, Rich, and there's a lot, forgive me that there's so many moving targets out there, folks, but this is just the way it is. Even if something starts lawful, if you continue to use an unreasonable amount of force after the threat has been quelled, that counts against you, right? But on the other hand, a person is allowed to defend himself, and also if this person was a lawless aggressor, which Neely seemed to be, you're allowed to detain him until the police come. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this idea that, well, everybody was off the train and the threat was over, they're allowed to hold him until the cops show up. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes a complicating factor as well. To my mind, the thing is, you have two questions to answer in every case as a prosecutor. One is, do we have a technical violation of law? If Alvin Bragg, who I have no patience for, were to answer that question yes, I could not criticize him for that because there may be a negligent homicide here. We don't know all the facts yet, but I can't say that, like, at a certain point, too much the force became unreasonable and that had a causative effect on whether this guy died or not. We need to know much more about the facts. I want to know much more, for example, about the toxicology study they must have done on Neely and so on. So those facts have to be run to ground. But then the second question you have to ask in every case, even assuming you have a technical violation of law, is should we bring this case? Is it in the public interest to exercise discretion to bring the case? And that question entails within it, among other considerations, will a jury of 12 people convict at trial, which is a different question from would it be rational for them to convict? You know, is it likely that they'll convict? I think it's highly unlikely that he'll get convicted mm-hmm. from based on what I know about this case and what I know about New York juries who ride the subway.
Yeah. So we wanted to get to these FBI whistleblowers who were testifying in a Jim Jordan hearing. You were appalled by their testimony and what it said about the FBI, but we will get to that next week because that's all the time we have for this episode. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich. Let's go, Mets.
Live life at your pace. Click the banner or go to visitwilliamsburg.com to discover how. Because here in Williamsburg, life moves at one pace, yours. Scramble through our world-class golf courses or shop your way through the square. Be one with nature as you hike or bike through our parks and trails or hunker down at one of our breweries. And when it's time to eat, be sure to bite into our eclectic food scene. It's all waiting for you in Williamsburg. Book your trip today and live life at your pace.